So please hang around and contribute to the discussion throughout the next session. So we'll move to the next session then on terrestrial ecosystems. Michel Laureau should be kicking off the this session. I can't see if Michel is there. I presume you are.
I'm there.
Hi, Michel. Great. Happy to see you. So please, let me introduce you for a second. So Michel works in the SET Experimental Institute from the CNRS in Moulis in France, and has been working on biodiversity ecosystem function research since a long time, and has a lot of expertise in the topic. So looking forward to hearing your thoughts.
Yes, since I knew that Hélène would talk about my own work, then I decided to talk about a different topic. No, I'm joking, but I would like to come back to a really key issue in ecosystem ecology, because we are talking in this meeting about the principles that underlie functioning, ecosystem functioning on land and in the sea, but actually a more fundamental question that is, in my opinion, still unresolved, is what is an ecosystem? And that's the question that I would like to address here. And the same question can be asked both on land and in the sea. So actually, you know, there has been a long debate about whether ecosystems are some kind of super organism or a simple collection of individuals. Actually, that's how the ecosystem concept was first proposed. Because in the beginning of the 20th century, there was a famous guy called Clemens, who said that plant communities were basically a kind of super organism that gradually developed to a climax, just as individual organisms developed during ontogeny. And then there was a big debate with Gleason, who proposed just the opposite viewpoint, that plant associations, he wouldn't even talk about communities, just associations, were just associations of individuals that happened to be there basically by chance, you know, because of migration and the environment is favorable and things like that, but nothing to do with a kind of organismic integration of the community. And then the ecosystem concept actually was defined by Tamsley in the 1930s. Actually, he defined the concept in opposition to Clemens' superorganismic view, which is quite interesting because if you read his paper, he actually talked about ecosystems as quasi-organisms. So he was really, actually, while he was criticizing Clemens, he was using very similar concepts. And so it's quite interesting to see the history of that whole debate. Okay, so the ecosystem concept clearly has evolved a lot since then. And despite that, I still believe that the same tension between the two extreme viewpoints has persisted. And actually, when you look at debates in both ecology and evolution, you see the same controversies coming up again and again. For instance, the controversy over group selection in the 1960s was basically about that issue in evolutionary biology. The controversy over the Gaia hypothesis then in the 70s and 80s and later was about the same kind of issue, in fact, at a larger scale, at the whole Earth system scale. So the problem, the disturbing aspect, I think, is that these controversies recur without showing any sign of resolution. So they come back and then people get fed up and then they come back again a bit later. And yet we have strong arguments to actually at least reject both viewpoints, both extreme viewpoints. For instance, when you take into account species interactions in communities or ecosystems, clearly species interactions are not compatible with an individualistic view, because there are many kinds of types of interactions between species. There are consumer resource interactions, spatial interactions, non-trophic interactions, interactions with the abiotic environment, and all that coexists within a single ecosystem. And believing that, you know, these interactions don't have any impact on the ecology and evolution of the components of the ecosystem doesn't seem to make sense. And so there must be some, at least some degree of integration of the, at the ecosystem level. And we now have a lot of empirical data to support these approach to species interactions. So clearly, you know, the purely individualistic viewpoint doesn't seem to work. But then if you move to the other extreme, species interactions also don't support the super organismic view. For instance, we spent quite a bit of time working on the grazing optimization hypothesis some time ago. That's a hypothesis that was proposed by some empirical ecosystem ecologists saying that primary production should increase along a gradient of grazing intensity. And they were actually, some of these people were starting to talk about the kind of mutualistic interaction between herbivores and plants. And that would actually be compatible with a tight degree of integration in the ecosystem. Actually, if you think in evolutionary terms, this is an incomplete view at best, because if you have, for instance, two different plant types, one tolerant and one resistant, both types will both benefit from the same, because the main mechanism is recycling of nutrients by herbivores. And so both would benefit from this recycling, but actually the tolerant type would suffer a cost from being eaten by a herbivore. And so, you know, with a simple evolutionary argument, you could clearly see that, you know, it's not the most tolerant plant that would evolve. And in fact, if you build a spatially explicit model with a path structure, the herbivore eats plants and recycle nutrient locally, then you could potentially evolve towards some kind of grazing optimization, not really optimization, but some kind of plant palatability, because some plants can benefit indirectly from recycling because it's locally clamped. But the figure here show that, you know, as you need a very extreme level of clumping to actually reach the level of grazing optimization. And so this is actually a general feature of evolutionary problems, is that as soon as you have competition at lower levels of organization, you can't have true optimization at the next level. So if you truly want optimization at one hierarchical level, then you need to suppress competition completely at the lower level. So that's a very general principle. So clearly the super organismic view doesn't hold fully either. And so we are left with the conclusion that reality should lie somewhere in between, right? We recently showed that actually it's quite easy to get a continuum from one extreme to the other with just, you know, competitive interactions among plants, for instance. If you change the level of competition, so the average strength of interaction along the x-axis here, or the variability of competition strengths among species, you can get a whole lot of different outcomes. I'm not going to go into the details, but simply show at the different points here, you can get very different community patterns in space. For instance, when you are at a very low level of competition, you basically recover the individualistic viewpoint. species behave individually. So they, well, here it's not at the individual level, but at the species level, they behave independently. So you get these nice spatial distribution curves that are Gaussian. But as you move towards higher level of mean competition or variability in competition, you can get very strong patterns in space such that, you know, these communities here look very much like a superorganism because they change simultaneously along a gradient. Okay, so now the question is really, how integrated are ecosystems? So where are we along this continuum? And actually answering this question, there's no real answer to this question. It's been very challenging for several reasons, and I just mentioned two. One reason is that the ecosystem concept is broad enough to be applied to a very wide range of different systems and scales, from very small microcosm to the entire biosphere. You can apply the same thinking, the same concepts. And another reason is that ecosystems are what has been called medium number systems. They are too large to be described by simple dynamical models, but too small to be described by statistical mechanical approaches. So we need to find something in between. And one outcome of these problems is that in many areas of ecology, still today, you clearly have an individualistic viewpoint. For instance, you have that in when you see all the models predicting the effects of climate change on the future of biodiversity. All these models ignore species interactions or ecosystem level constraints completely. So what is interesting is that this kind of individualistic viewpoint pervades many areas of ecology and to the point where we might miss a lot of interesting patterns and processes. And I just want to give one example of a pattern that we personally, I didn't expect when we started this work with Ian Hatton. We discovered by using a lot of data on predator-prey interactions that actually the scaling of predator biomass with prey biomass, here it's in the African savanna, was not isometric. So the exponent of the relationship between the two is roughly 3/4, which in fact means that when you increase prey biomass, you move from a relatively top-heavy biomass pyramid to a relatively bottom-heavy pyramid. We tried to look at possibly lower-level phenomena that could explain that changes in abundance, change in size structure, but actually this didn't explain the pattern. What really seems to be happening is that you have this change at the ecosystem level, a change in trophic structure. What is interesting is that you find exactly the same pattern at the individual level. So you have this famous 3/4 power law linking production and body mass within a trophic level and within a single organism, and you have a very nice relationship across all organisms known on Earth. And what is really interesting is that you get exactly the same exponent and relationship at the ecosystem level or at the individual level. And so this raises really important questions whether ecosystems now are perhaps more integrated than we believed previously. And we don't have a clear mechanism to explain that, but actually one possible mechanism might be density dependence acting at the ecosystem level. Because we've studied density dependence mostly at the individual population levels, but that's because of technical constraints or interest. But actually, it might well be that you have a stronger regulation of entire trophic levels than of component populations. So it's a hypothesis. It's not proved, but it's an interesting hypothesis, I think. Now, what I would like to show also is that an individualistic viewpoint, may prevent us from seeing really interesting patterns, but also, having a more mechanistic approach at the population level can also help ecosystem ecology. And I would like to take as an example of this, the longstanding diversity stability debate, which is also one of the oldest debates in ecology. Ecosystem ecology has traditionally considered that stability emerges at the ecosystem level because there are many different population level processes. But in community ecology, Bob May and others changed that view completely and promoted a new paradigm, which is that diversity and complexity should actually beget instability rather than stability. What is interesting is that the recent experiments on biodiversity and ecosystem have shown that the two types of relationships can hold simultaneously at different levels of organization. For instance, when you take the famous Cedar Creek experiment in Minnesota, this is a huge experiment where Dave Tillman and his team have manipulated the diversity of plants within large plots. We did the same in Europe in the BioLabs experiment with a smaller but more numerous plots. And in both cases, you find a very interesting pattern that ecosystem stability, which is basically measured by the level of variability within through time in the productivity of the various plots. So ecosystem stability increases with the number of species at the ecosystem level, but within the same plots, if you disaggregate production by species, then you see that actually at the population level, you get a decreasing trend with the same data. You get basically the same pattern in BioLab. So except that now the scale is inverted. So it's the it was previously invariability, the level of constancy through time. Here is variability. So variability decreases at the community level, but increases at the species level in the same plot. And actually their theory about that, explaining why this happens, is basically the fact that different species behave, respond differently to environmental fluctuations. And we gathered some evidence that this happens in the BioLabs plot. Well, I don't have the time to go into the details. So I just want to go to the conclusion of my talk. I think that the tension between population and ecosystem approaches in ecology is not necessarily an issue. It can be fertile if it's not congealed in those extreme viewpoints, that seem to be completely opposed to one another. It must be clear that ecosystems are neither superorganisms nor mere collections of individuals. They are dynamic entities in which there are constraints at both levels of organizations. The relative importance of these constraints at the ecosystem or individual level is still a largely unsolved question, to be honest, both on land and in the sea. And there might be difference between the two. So recent advances suggest that both top-down and bottom-up approaches are needed to address these issues. So what I mean by that is when we can start studying the system as a whole and then go down to search for mechanisms, or we can go in the opposite direction, start from component populations and then start building up what is important at the ecosystem level. So hopefully narrowing the gap between the two approaches will pave the way for more integrative approaches that fully account for the dynamic interplay between individuals and ecosystems. And that's what I think is the main challenge for, especially for theoretical approaches, but maybe also for experimental approaches in the future. So thanks a lot. And for those interested, I've published this topic in a recent book chapter. So thank you.
Thank you, Michel. Excellent. A lot of food for thought there. Do we have some questions from anybody?
Yeah, I was wondering, listening for your presentation, about some recent attempts that are ongoing on, notably on microbial ecology, where actually people start to try to understand both populations and organisms by just looking for their collection of metabolic activity. So rather than looking for meta-organisms, they are looking for meta-metabolism. And what's your point of view on those aspects? And if it's, because it do in your both the organism and individual and population levels, right? And do you think that could be a solution, or that could be a trap?
No, I think it's people working in microbial ecology. I'm not a microbial ecologist myself, but I see a lot of interesting new developments in that field, including people who are trying to build ecological theories based on very basic principles, even more basic than we know in classical ecology, starting from chemical reactions in a bacteria. And from there, they want to build, you know, a whole theory up to the ecosystem level. Personally, I don't think that we will ever be able to achieve everything with just that approach. But, you know, it's another approach that I think is very interesting and can lead to a new understanding of ecosystems. And so basically, I think that we really have to approach it from different angles, and maybe sometime in the future, we'll be able to, you know, to bring them a bit more together and to have something in between. But we are really stuck with that, I think, still stuck, even in microbial ecologies. It's not clear that they've reached that point, you know, in my opinion. But we are still a bit stuck between these top-down and bottom-up approaches, I think, even in microbial ecology. But they have new approaches that are quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you say, the metabolic approach may be more amenable to microbial work, which maybe brings me to ask you a question about relating to your thoughts about Vernadsky's ideas. Alexander Vernadsky, who was, you know, maybe the father of biogeochemistry, and thinking about how ecosystems work biogeochemically. Some of his first ideas were, you know, he sort of had difficulty to believe that individual metabolic reactions could evolve independently, but, you know, he sort of saw that that an ecosystem was sort of put in place at the same time, that the whole thing, the structure sort of emerged out of somewhere, rather than individual reactions, redox reactions and so on, evolving first and then being sort of merged together. He sort of saw the whole thing coming together within a biosynosis. I struggle to understand how that could happen from a mechanistic point of view, but I find these ideas very interesting. Obviously, they're more than 100 years old now, and, you know, our knowledge has moved on. But, you know, I think these general concepts have something that maybe can be useful to think about, at least in terms of thinking about how the biogeochemical fabric of the planet was established by microbes. It doesn't leave any space for why macroorganisms, why did animals, plants evolve? Because in principle you don't need them to make the planet function. But It's anyhow an interesting idea. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on Vernadsky and his ideas of the biosynosis level of organization.
I didn't read Vernadsky himself, but it strikes me that this is the same kind of debate that we're having for the Gaia hypothesis, right?
Yeah.
Also have an amazing number of patterns that hold and processes at the whole system, Earth system level, that and Lovelock was had the perspective that if we were looking at Earth from another planet, from elsewhere, then we would see that as a clear pattern. But when we are inside the system, we don't see that. But the question remains, how does that emerge, and why, and what is the respective role of the constraints at lower level of organizations or higher level of organizations? I don't believe that a single complex system like that emerges just boom out of nothing. It evolves through time, and as Andy Knoll shows earlier, I mean, it has changed quite a lot during the Earth history. And so it's really a fascinating topic, the origin of life, and then the origin of ecosystems is an equally interesting topic that I think is still understudied. I mean, well, we have some elements, the proof is Andy's talk, but we still have a lot of unresolved questions, I think. And so, yeah, I don't think that Vernadsky's ideas resolve the issue. I mean, they propose to look at it from a different perspective than perhaps most people today would, but it doesn't resolve the question, in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I have one question, please?
Yep, go ahead, Sergio.
Bonjour, Michel. My question is regarding the book of Schrödinger, What's Life? And he suggested that life is actually trying to evolve the production of entropy. Do you think that might be this view, which is quite old now, can also explain the self-organizations of ecosystems as an entity self-organized in a way that it maximizes entropy in the universe, not internal entropy, which gets more order by having flux diffusion, etc., like heat, to the environment, to the universe, it becomes more entropy in the total universe.
Okay, so that's another aspect of the debate that was actually also debated for the Gaia hypothesis. You know, there was a very interesting debate about entropy maximization to explain patterns at the whole Earth system level. You should read it because it's really fascinating to see the pros and cons. And but basically, I mean, the cons would reply to you that entropy maximization is just a statistical pattern. It doesn't explain anything. I mean, it's just a way of maximizing some quantity such that you actually have the most likely outcome possible among the many possible outcomes. But then it doesn't explain why it's just that one. And actually, in that debate about Gaia, I can send you papers if you want that address this issue. And it's really fascinating about, what is a constraint and what is a degree of freedom when you look at evolution. It's really hard to define. And so it's a kind of, it can quickly become a circular argument, and that's basically the core of the debate. So,
thank you.
Right. Any other comments, Andy, Maurizio?
I'll just make a quick one. Thanks, Michel. That was a wonderful talk. I learned a lot from it. In terms of this sort of Gaian idea that somehow groups are evolving to maximize entropy or stability. It seems to me that the reason we have animals is not because animals precursors sat around and thinking, how can we maximize entropy in the universe? But rather that by being multicellular, they could gather more food and avoid predation by protists. So I think we do have to get back into the weeds of the actual function of organisms to understand their consequences for ecosystems. And the other comment just goes back to Vernadsky, which is certainly interesting reading. But again, you know, we don't have to evolve complex microbial ecosystems de novo because there are no reactants that microbes use in metabolism that are not made abiotically. And so, you know, you can make sulfate, you can make ferric iron, you can make nitrate abiotically, and then organisms could evolve to use those. And through time, biology becomes the major producer of those. And so again, it would evolve through time, but you don't need any magic to make a complex ecosystem come together instantaneously.
Can you split water abiotically to make oxygen?
You can make oxygen. In fact, you know, Mars doesn't have life, but it does have oxygen. And the way you do it is to have water vapor go into the upper atmosphere where photochemistry breaks it into oxygen and hydrogen. Hydrogen is light enough to depart the system and oxygen remains.
May I make a comment on this? Not about splitting water, but what you would say, in fact, is saying that life create novelties. Yeah. Okay, so and I think at the end, this is the basic idea of Gaia, besides the self-organizing thing, etc. Gaia is just saying that life shaped the environment in a way that without life would be different. And that environment is more stable in terms of variability, and we will discuss about stability later, I assume. So this is the life is really a relevant product of evolution.
I think we could debate a long time about Gaia. But sure. I think Gaia theory is saying more than that. But we can debate about that because there are different interpretations of that approach and. Yeah, well, some people have interpreted Gaia to mean that actually life, and to some extent Lovelock said that, despite what people say, that actually life is creating the conditions for life itself. So it's creating its own favorable conditions. Mm. And that's why there have been so many debates. And to some extent, this is probably true, you know, but we don't know why and how evolution plays there. And so that's why evolutionary biologists have tended to think that this is crazy. And ecosystem ecologists have tended to feel that evolutionary biologists don't understand anything. And so they were unable to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, but you know, Andy just say that without trees, the albedo would be so different that the climate would be significantly changed, right?
But I think that both sides would agree on that. Mm-hmm. I think it's more, how does this happen? How is this evolving? And why is this the case? And what are the consequences that there are debates? The simple fact, I think, that evolutionary biologists would agree with.
All right, I think we'd better move on. As you say, Michel, we can go on forever talking about this. It would be better to talk about this over a beer after the meeting, which we sadly can't do. But anyway, thanks, Michel. That was great to kick us off on the terrestrial ecosystem session. So let's move on with Fernando. Fernando Maestre from Alicante. I hope you are there.
So, bonjour, good afternoon, everyone. And yeah, thanks a lot to Chris and the organizers for inviting me. It's really a real pleasure to be here. And I will be talking about the importance of biodiversity as a driver of ecosystem functioning across dryland ecosystems. And I will be talking about some of the things that have been already discussed, but mostly from an empirical perspective. So I will be talking all the time about dryland ecosystems, which I guess most of you, or at least some of you, will be familiar with. As you know, drylands are water-limited ecosystems. And because of this, usually the landscapes, these environments, are not fully covered by vegetation. And also because of this, these are low-productive ecosystems that are mostly driven by abiotic factors, like resources, and particularly water, And traditionally, the focus when studying the ecology of biodiversity of dry lands have been also had been the role played by abiotic factors and mostly rainfall and water availability on ecosystem functioning. Not many studies really have focused on the potential role of biodiversity. But drylands have also, the biodiversity in drylands is quite unique and it's really high. If you ask someone in the street about a biodiverse ecosystem, the most likely is that he or she will not tell a dryland, right? He or she will be thinking about, you know, tropical forest or temperate grasslands. But really, the dryland biodiversity in drylands is quite unique. Here, for instance, this is from a recent review where we just put here for the dryland ecoregions the number of species they have according to the UPIF data. And you can see how there are several really hotspots like the Mediterranean Basin, south of Africa, parts of Australia, and some deserts in South and North America. And drylands are also very important, not only because they have a quite unique biodiversity, but also they are very important at the global scale because of the global extent. And because they cover more than 40% of the terrestrial surface and also host over 40% of the global population. So they are critical for regulating many, many aspects on the Earth system. But it's interesting, and that's one of my motivations when I started to become interested in ecology as a student, that if you go to the textbooks, if you go to the main literature on topics like biodiversity and ecosystem functioning, most of the studies come from ecosystems other than drylands. And from the very beginning of my research career, I really wanted to contribute to fill this gap, and all the research we do is focused on drylands. And this topic of the role of biodiversity as a driver of ecosystem functioning has been one of the main research lines in my lab over the last 15 years. And to talk about this, I would like to present some results that we have obtained from the Biodesert Survey, which is was at the time the first global standardized survey that was coordinated by myself and by my research group in Spain. And we were able to survey with the help of lots of colleagues from all over the world, over 240 dryland ecosystems from all continents except Antarctica. And we surveyed them using the same standardized protocols. So we collected field data on vegetation, on the cover, the spatial pattern, the diversity of vegetation. We collected soil samples, and those were shipped to Spain, where we analyzed them in the lab. All the samples were analyzed for the same variables in the same lab, where we quantify multiple soil variables related to carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus cycling that we use as proxy of ecosystem functions like nitrogen cycling and biological productivity, which are also proxies of important and ecosystem services across global drylands. So I will present now some of the results. I will go very, very quick. No, don't have much time to enter into the details. If you have any question, please stop and ask them. And in this slide, I present just the first set of results we published from this survey some years ago, where we just try to explore a very simple question. Is the role, the relationship between biodiversity, and in this case, we use plant species richness in the x-axis. Here are square root transform, so the numbers are low. And ecosystem multifunctionality. And with this, we just try to quantify the capacity or the ability of ecosystems to provide multiple functions at the same time. And we measure multifunctionality using a very simple index, where we standardize the different soil variables related to carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus cycling, and we did the average of these standardized variables using C-scores. And we did this for multifunctionality, which is all the functions, and for functions related to carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus cycling. And as you can see here, the scatter was really widespread. Remember, this is a global natural survey. And in this case, we are not controlling for anything other than that we avoided during the survey highly disturbed ecosystems like agricultural areas that largely impact areas by humans. So we include here natural and semi-natural ecosystems. And for all the multifunctionality and different nitrogen cycling indexes, we observe a weak but positive relationship between species richness and ecosystem function. It was significant, which was not a surprise, but in all cases explained less than 5% of the variation found in data. However, we did additional modeling analysis And even if this fraction was very low, this was a unique fraction of the among multiple predictors of the multifunctionality. So which was some evidence that biodiversity will play, and in this case, species richness, a unique role as a driver of ecosystem functioning in across global drylands. We continue working on this data. We collected using databases, trade data. We were not able to measure them in situ, but we were able to collect trade data from databases for important traits like a specific area or height, which are very important in drylands for defining multiple multiple proxies of nitrogen cycling. And we did additional modeling to look at the importance of taxonomic diversity, richness, and also functional diversity using different metrics accounting for the mean, the variance, and the skewness and kurtosis of these functional traits. And of course, we build models with all these biodiversity proxies and multiple abiotic factors that we know that are critically important drivers of dryland structure and functioning, like, you know, aridity as a proxy of climate, and soil variables like texture, pH, and of course, geographical variables for control for potential autocorrelation in the data. So this is a complex modeling, but I just would like to point to two important results. Is that, you know, the models were pretty good, explain more than 60% of the variation in the data. And again, species richness had a positive but a small effect, but still was significant. But when incorporating proxies of functional diversity, the predictive capability, the models and the predictive capability of biodiversity increase. The importance of biodiversity as a driver of ecosystem functioning increase. We continue exploring this database and gathering additional information. We were able to build the phylogenetic tree of all the more than 1,000 perennial plant species found across the global survey. And using different metrics, we were able to evaluate the relative importance of taxonomic, phylogenetic, and functional diversity as drivers of ecosystem functioning. This has been also a quite hot topic in community ecology, looking at the different biodiversity attributes or proxies when exploring biodiversity ecosystem functioning relationship. In one of the previous talks by Hélène, she also highlighted the importance of phylogeny. And what we observed is that different functions, we did again a similar modeling, including different metrics of taxonomical, functional, and phylogenetic diversity, accounting for both the dominance of the species and also the diversity of the species. There are lots of metrics to quantify functional phylogenetic diversity and also taxonomic diversity, accounting for these things. And we used several indexes that were largely uncorrelated among them to try to tease out, at least statistically, the relative importance of these biodiversity proxies. And what we observe is that simultaneous increases in species richness, in phylogenetic diversity deep in time, and also on functional redundancy increase ecosystem multifunctionality. When we look at particular functions related to carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus, then the relative importance of this biodiversity proxy change. For instance, for carbon, the community weighted mean of height, let's say the dominance of the height of the dominant plant species played, for instance, a key role. But for instance, for nitrogen, the phylogenetic diversity deep in time was particularly important, and also the functional dispersion of leaf traits. And for phosphorus, other biodiversity metrics also were important. So again, more evidence of the importance of biodiversity. Some of these biodiversity proxies pop up as some of the most important drivers or drivers that explain most of the variation found in the data, but different biodiversity metrics influence different aspects of ecosystem multifunctionality. We also have been looking at the role of biodiversity in abiotic factors as a driver of ecosystem stability. You've seen in previous talks, like Michelle ones, he also shown some graphs about the positive role of biodiversity as a driver of ecosystem stability. And using similar approaches, but with observational data, we also evaluated at a global scale what was the importance of biodiversity, in this case, species richness and functional diversity as a driver of ecosystem stability, using measuring stability as productivity quantified using satellite data. Again, we found pretty good models, explain more than 70% of the data, the variance of the data, and abiotic factors were particularly important. This is something that pop up in all our models, not a surprise. We are working in drylands, so the more water you have, the higher the productivity, the higher the functioning, of course. But still, you know, species richness and functional traits were also important predictors. And also, interestingly, they interacted with climate. In more arid sites, species richness was particularly important, and in less arid sites, other functional diversity was more important than species richness. So that's also some interesting patterns that we have observed in our data. And of course, we are dealing with correlation observational data, so we try to tease out cause and effect using statistical approaches. This has been also discussed during Ellen's talk, but of course we never can be full 100% sure that we can assume cause and effect relationship using this data. So we complement our observational approaches at large geographical scales, at the global scale, with modeling and with experiments conducted at the local scale. We have been conducting multiple experiments over the year on this topic using different model organisms of vascular plants, soil microorganisms, and soil lichens and mosses that form part of biological soil crust, which are communities, soil surface communities that are very important in drylands. And I would like to present some data from a very recent experiment that was published a few months ago, where we in this case, we use LIDAR. So we manipulated diversity. And in this particular case, we were particularly interested in looking at different aspects of functional diversity using two important functional traits in plant litter, specifically area and the content of lignin. And we collected litter from dryland ecosystems and from many other ecosystems across the world, thanks to a global network of collaborators. And we manipulated in the lab the mean, the variance, the skewness, and the kurtosis of the distribution of these traits within our microcosms to look at different aspects of functional diversity, impact on soil function. And we look at dominance, dispersion, rarity, and evenness. And what we observed in a similar way, what we have observed at the global scale, is that different diversity components impact in a different way ecosystem, different functions, and multifunctionality. In this particular experiment, we found that higher evenness and combined with other functional diversity proxies enhance multifunctionality. Not going to explain the results in detail; they are quite complex. You can find all the details in the paper. But again, we found experimental evidence that biodiversity matters for ecosystem functioning, and that different diversity aspects, proxies, particularly functional diversity ones, are important for ecosystem function. We have observed similar results using other model systems. So some take home messages very, very briefly is that we are dealing with drylands with our water limited ecosystems. So abiotic factors, mostly water availability, play a key role as a driver of ecosystem functioning, but still, you know, biodiversity play an important role, and different biodiversity proxies, different biodiversity aspects impact in a different way different ecosystem functions. So this is an interesting new knowledge that we are providing that also can help to manage and to restore dryland ecosystems. And I will stop here. I just didn't want to use a lot of time, but I would like also, of course, to give thanks to all our people in my lab and our international network of collaborators, because without them, our work will not be possible, and of course to all the funding agencies. So thanks a lot also for your listening, and if you have any questions, I will be happy to try to answer them. Thanks.
Thanks, great, Fernando. Do we have some questions online?
I have a quick one.
Excuse me. Let me stop sharing. Oh, okay, yep. Thanks.
Okay, over to you, Sergio.
Just a technical probably one. is about your last, before last slide, in which you have estimators for statistical properties of the distribution, mean, variance, etc.
Let me share the screen. This one.
Yeah, so then, this one is fine. Then you have all these four statistical properties, mean, variance, skewness, and kurtosis, and you assign a concept to them, dominance, dispersion, rarity, and evenness. But I'm a little surprised because even in the second case in which you call it dispersion, you can also have the rarity concept or the evenness concept. So could you clarify a little bit why did you assign these categories to things that for me are mixed up?
Yeah, thanks for this question. It's really a very pertinent one. There is a long debate also. There have been lots of indexes, you know, developed to quantify these aspects of diversity. And of course, it's really important. It's quite difficult. It's quite difficult to, you know, fully disentangle, you know, to fully disentangle all these components because they are not independent. And, you know, we know, you know, in natural ecosystems, these properties are not independent, and we know that. And there have been also a lot of mathematical developments, you know, quantifying this interdependence. But we did this in this way because it was experimentally, you know, the best we could do to try to tease out the relative importance of the different aspects of diversity. But even if they are not, you know, 100% independent, you know, they are at least in the experimental setting. Because here we are controlling the rest of conditions, so we are sure that the effects that we see are due to these differences in the properties of the distribution of the leader, which is what we use to try to tease out these different diversity components. It was like the best solution we could find to try to tease out these different biodiversity aspects, even if we know that it may not be 100% perfect, because it's quite difficult to really get like a full independent measurement or set up an experiment where you can fully disentangle these aspects.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do we have any more questions? If not, maybe the best is to save questions until later, since we're running a little late. So, shall we move on? So thanks, Fernando. Great. Let's move now to Nico Eisenhower from Leipzig, who will, tell us something about soil ecosystems.
Hello.
Hi, Nico. Good to see you.
Can you hear me well?
Yes, perfect.
Chris, thanks a lot for inviting me. It's a really great honor to be invited to speak with so many fantastic scientists. Yes, it's about soil. So you should now see my presentation. And I thought, because it's a Friday afternoon, we might be running late, I thought that should be somehow appealing to you, despite the fact that it's about soil. So I'm talking about the dark side of biodiversity with a link to Star Wars. In principle, it's about biodiversity, some functioning relationships in terrestrial ecosystems. And I'm particularly interested in the role of above below ground interactions in these terrestrial ecosystems. I'm sitting here at IDIF. We are almost done building this hopefully impactful center that's enriching biodiversity research. And when I'm now presenting results, this is teamwork, effort, and certainly not only my work. So my group is called Experimental Interaction Ecology. And I'm sorry that I'm presenting something quite biased, focusing mostly on my research or on our research, but I then also put particular emphasis on some aspects that I thought could be interesting for this group of people and our discussions. We are mostly interested in, first of all, global biodiversity distribution, mostly soil biodiversity. We are then studying drivers of biodiversity, not only looking at global relationships, but also local effects by performing global change experiments. And then we are also performing biodiversity experiments to look at the ecosystem function, ecosystem consequences of biodiversity change. And I don't have to bore you with this figure that you probably are very well aware of. Biodiversity is changing. And as already said, we are mostly interested in the ecosystem consequences of this biodiversity change. And I would like to start with this working group that we had some years ago. You also see here Michel as a very important contributor. And what we did was summarizing information from more than 40 different grassland biodiversity experiments. So highly controlled experiments where the number of plant species was manipulated. And first of all, we looked at productivity as affected by the number of species. And in these experiments, irrespective of the conditions, if it was a dry or wet year or normal year, you see this positive relationship between productivity and biodiversity. The novel contribution of this paper was that also a measure of stability, here resistance, increased with biodiversity. And yeah, Michel Leroux and co-workers have done a fantastic job also working on yeah, the theoretical basis of this, how different species complement each other, how they are asynchronous and then add up to a more stable community. The question is, how is the effect of biodiversity on ecosystem functioning? What's the shape of this relationship? And in order to study this, we looked into two long-term experiments in Cedar Creek in Minnesota, the Big Biodiversity Experiment by Dave Tillman and the Biocon Experiment by Peter Reich. And we could find all kinds of relationships, or at least different shapes. You can see here a measure of plant biomass production plotted against plant species richness. And the different colors now symbolize different experimental years, with early years of these experiments showing quite weak relationships, while long-term effects in more green and blue color showing very strong, almost linear relationships. So this has really important implications for the question, how relevant is biodiversity for ecosystem functioning? This clearly depends on also temporal dynamics. And now I'm really talking about short-term temporal dynamics, not deep time as done before. So why is this? Basically, when we set up such experiments, we start with tabula rasa. We start with homogenized soils with very, you can say, a destroyed environment. Maybe it's planet Earth at the beginning, maybe a bit more. So the starting conditions look like that. And over time, you need these complex communities above ground and also below ground to assemble, to form their biotic interactions in these communities. And we are convinced that these interactions between, mostly between soil organisms and plants, play a particular role in explaining why you find an increasing strength of biodiversity effects on ecosystem functioning in these experiments. And the idea is that over time, in low plant diversity communities, you have mostly an accumulation of antagonists and a net effect dominance of this effect of antagonists, while at high plant diversity of an accumulation of more mutualists. There is some empirical evidence, for example, from the Jena experiment that you can see here. We saw that there are really strong bottom-up effects in this experiment from plant diversity on above and below ground food webs. You can see herbivores above ground and also herbivores below ground, and then also predators feeding on these herbivores. And what we are also seeing is that many different ecosystem functions that depend on interactions between these organisms are driven or are dependent on plant species richness. You can see that there are, we have multiple examples here, but what I would like to really focus on is this more recent example, how we try to integrate all of this information from different trophic levels, different groups, organisms that act at very different spatial scales, from microbes to insects, for example. And this is this food web approach to calculating energy fluxes. Basically, what we need is the individual body masses of the critters or organisms that we are catching on these plots above and below ground. We can then calculate individual metabolic rates. We can assign a network topology, who feeds on whom and how much. And we can consider additional information on metabolic rates and on assimilation efficiencies of these different components to then calculate energy fluxes of these entire food webs. And what this can show us is, or what it could indicate, is that the energy that, for example, flows from plants to detritivores could then be related to decomposition. The energy that goes from plants to herbivores can be called herbivory. And then the energy going from detritivores and herbivores to predators can then be summarized as predation. And we use this approach to calculate, first of all, total energy flux in these food webs. This is now only above ground, but we are also at the moment doing this for below ground communities. And we did it in this study for the Jena experiment and for Cedar Creek, the big biodiversity experiment. So this now looks like a very weak relationship, but note that this is on a logarithmic scale. So a positive relationship between total energy flux through these soil food webs as affected by plant diversity. We can extract herbivory from this whole food web, and also predation both increase with plant diversity. And then we can also bring these data sets together and calculate things like net herbivore control. So how is this herbivore community controlled by bottom-up and top-down effects in this complex food web? And we can see that this herbivore control increases with plant diversity. And at the same time, the net effect of herbivores on an individual plant or on plant biomass decreases with plant diversity. This provides some explanation why there is more plant biomass growing with more plant diversity. In the future, we are also trying to look at multi-trophic diversity, multifunctionality relationships in an ecotron that we built close by. You can see these eco units here. We built 24 of those to manipulate above and below ground communities, the complexity of these communities, and then look at multiple ecosystem functions. You just saw an earthworm. I always need to show at least one earthworm per presentation. That's my rule. So this was the earthworm of today. And we are also looking at more multi-trophic interactions or interactions between the above ground communities and below ground communities in different experimental settings, like the MIDIF experiment, where we particularly focus on tree mycorrhizal interactions that play a critical role in nutrient uptake and also water uptake. The basic idea of this experiment is that as you maximize tree species richness and also the diversity of different mycorrhizal types, you should also maximize ecosystem functions. And this is an approach to integrate more multi-trophic information. And however, there is very limited information on below ground communities, and we are also doing or trying to do global biodiversity ecosystem functioning relationships at this global scale. When you try to do this for the soil, the data is very limited, as we summarized this lately. So there is some biodiversity information below ground, some biomass, really few function measurements. So we are a bit limited, but we are contributing by summarizing information on soil biodiversity here, for example, a recent synthesis of global earthworm diversity data. And we are now trying to relate this diversity data to also different ecosystem functions. We are doing this in the context of SOILBON. This is a soil biodiversity and ecosystem functioning monitoring network. Also Fernando is part of this, so I'm very happy to see many of you today. This is also supposed to then inform policymakers about the health of soils. So I would like to thank you for your attention again, also for inviting me and some funders for their support. And I would like to show this figure here at the end, because we come from different fields. We work at very different spatial and temporal scales. And I thought that maybe this energy flux perspective could be interesting as a discussion starter, or could be inspiring, because it can also be used to not only bridge different scales, but also to bridge different ecosystem types, as depicted in this figure here. It's also from the Barnes et al. Paper, where we also highlighted that there are these that ecosystems are connected through the flow of energy. So with that, I'm stopping here. I saved a bit of time, and I'm very happy to try to answer questions.
Excellent. Thank you, Nico. So do we have some questions?
Could I ask a question, please?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Nico. That was really interesting. I guess the question I had concerns viruses. We know in marine ecosystems that viruses play actually a rather large role. It's been estimated that, you know, maybe a third of phytoplankton cells are lysed every day, and they potentiate this microbial loop. I guess my question, which is one of ignorance, is, do we know anything about the potential role played by viruses in terrestrial ecosystems?
The literature that I know and I've been contributing to have mostly ignored viruses so far, but I do know some colleagues that specifically focus on viruses, not only in soils, and but also in groundwater, for example, where they can also play an important role, so more limnic systems. I have colleagues here at IDIF that are also performing experiments with viruses, trying to understand how they influence, mostly in small bacterial model ecosystems, biodiversity effects, also different kinds of interactions and different ecosystem functions. But I think, as far as I know, we are only scratching the surface so far, but maybe others know more about that.
Okay.
I've got a question. I don't know any more about viruses, so definitely.
But it's a really important question, and we are starting to address related questions. Yeah.
So go ahead, Mike, if you've got a question.
Yeah, thanks, Nico. Really, really interesting. And I've not heard IDIF described as the Death Star before. I thought it was really, really interesting analogy. My question was around the, you mentioned this kind of limit, some of the limited knowledge we have around below ground ecosystems and their functioning. It was more around the kind of interaction between larger fauna and plants and below ground systems? And is that because that's hard to study in these experimental plots, this, the role of larger organisms, but we have quite a lot of exclosure experiments where some of those effects are taken out. Do we know much about the interaction between those, you know, those types of organisms and how they, the large organism might be affecting below ground ecosystems?
Yes, absolutely. I think there was really important work already being done and also nicely summarized in books led by David Waddle, for example, and colleagues, where they nicely summarized that depending on local environmental conditions and the fertility or productivity of an ecosystem, these effects of larger herbivores on below ground systems can be very significant, but also quite diverse. It depends a little bit if these large herbivores accelerate or to what extent they accelerate nutrient cycling. I think there are now also more recent studies on this in the context of nutrient network, where you can even look at interactions between large herbivores, fertility, additional nutrient inputs. And also Fernando is leading a global a project on herbivore effects in drylands. So I think we are gaining more and more knowledge, but yes, there are really strong effects. There have been many studies showing that with large herbivores, we also see more or higher levels of nutrient cycling than more soil activity and so on. And this can increase soil fertility. It could also contribute to carbon storage, for example. But again, effects are a little bit diverse depending on local conditions.
And establishment of such associations between the larger organisms and the soil system was presumably put in place over time, quite long periods of time, as the plants began to invade the land and establish soil ecosystems. And I wonder how much we know, how much we can dissect that out from the fossil record, Andy. You know, I know that there are some fossils of like fungal pathogens infecting algae, right? But I'm not sure what else there is from the fossil record that can help us sort of understand how these interactions were put in place.
Yeah, there's some good news on the terrestrial front, and that is there is a deposit of early Devonian age, about 407 million years old in Scotland, called the Rhynie Chert. And the Rhynie Chert is to the early evolution of terrestrial ecosystems, much like the famous Burgess Shale is for marine ecosystems in the Cambrian. And for years, people have studied the Rhynie, because you have exquisite anatomical preservation of land plants, including stem group vascular plants and stem group lycopods and that. But in recent years, people have started to look at what else is in there. There's 12 species of animals. 11 of them are arthropods, mostly chelicerates, but also the earliest insects. There's actually a pretty good record of nematodes, which are simultaneously probably the most abundant animals and the lowest fossil record of any animal group. But now people have described, you know, a real diversity of fungi, including saprophytes, mycorrhizae. We actually described testate amoebae a year or two ago. There are oomycetes. There are cyanobacteria in related aquatic areas and green algae. So what's interesting is that the first glimpse, and one of the few really clear glimpses we have of terrestrial ecosystems in sort of statu nascendi, shows that, you know, a lot of the key players are there early on.
Maybe I can add another. It's less fossil, but more recent. But I mostly mentioned herbivores in my response, but I particularly like a paper that was published a couple of years ago by Sobral and colleagues in Nature Ecology and Evolution, where they did really a major effort to assess multi-trophic interactions in tropical ecosystems. And basically what they did was they counted signs of herbivory, but also mostly on higher trophic level interactions, like signs of predation. They counted poop, all signs, also visual estimations of higher interactions. And this was highly correlated, the level of or the amount of these biotic interactions with carbon storage in the ecosystem, which I found very interesting because it moved the whole perspective at least one trophic level up the chain. So maybe this is also nice or interesting to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. Okay, in the interest of time, we maybe need to move on. I'm sorry we're a bit late. We all need a coffee. But anyway, Régis, I'm sure you'll keep us awake for another few minutes with ending this session.
Well, you've been keeping me awake. I'm jet lagged, just arriving from the US. But this is so fascinating.
It is,
thank you, Chris, for organizing this and inviting me. This is really amazing. So let me try to share my screen.
Yep, you're almost there.
Okay, so it's good?
Yes, that's great. Yeah, it's all yours.
All right, thank you. So the title of my talk is Eco-Evolutionary Dynamics of Ecosystem Function on Land and at Sea. And I'll start by saying that we think of evolution as a slow process unfolding on geological timescales, but evolution can be rapid. And what I mean by that is that evolution can unfold on the ecological timescale of interactions among organisms. And I'm a mathematical ecologist, and most of my research is about capturing this convergence of evolutionary and ecological timescales using the concept of eco-evolutionary feedback loop. And what I mean by eco-evo feedback loop is the process whereby individual traits influence their environment directly or via, let me try to activate this, via interactions among organisms. And this determines properties of the population, community, and the ecosystem as well. And these properties, the state of population, community, and ecosystem, actually generate selection agents that act on the potentially existing heritable variation in these individual traits. So based on this concept, we can ask questions such as, understanding the ecological causes and the ecological consequences of evolution. And so my lab studies the mechanisms and consequences of eco-evolutionary feedbacks across scales, from microscopic interactions at the scale of microorganisms to global ecosystem effects at planetary scale. And in this talk, I will focus on eco-evolutionary dynamics of carbon cycling and give a brief vignette on three topics. First is eco-evo feedbacks mediated by soil microbial decomposers and how they shape the response of soil carbon stock to warming. The second is basically the same kind of question, but for the microbial loop in the ocean and how the response of eco-evo feedbacks mediated by the microbial loop influence primary production and its response to warming. And finally, I'll go back to the question of a deep past, and I'll ask how eco-evo feedbacks driven by emerging ecosystems shaped the Earth atmosphere and climate in the deep past, and that is the late Hadean and early Archean. So I will be very brief about these topics, but I hope that we'll start some discussion and maybe follow up after this conference. So first topic, how eco-evo feedbacks mediated by soil microbial decomposers shape the response of soil carbon stock to warming. Well, as we all know, soils is a big repository of carbon with 2,300 petagrams, and heterotrophic respiration is quite a large component of a global carbon cycle. And key to microbial decomposition of soil organic matter that is underlying this respiration is a production by microbes of extracellular enzymes or exoenzymes that diffuse locally in the soil. So that's what you see here. And bind to soil organic compound, produce simple polymers that can then be eaten by the microbes. And basically, the key, one of the key parameters here is the investment that individual microbes make of the resources they acquire between growth, that you see here, and the production of these exoenzymes. And so there is this typical trade-off between growth and the production of degradative enzymes that may be a key parameter of the carbon fluxes in the soil. So how do climate warming influence the soil organic carbon stock, and how does it do so depending on exoenzyme production? So we can develop simple models of microbes and carbon in the soil with the action of exoenzymes. And what these models predict, basically summarized here, is the influence on soil organic carbon of temperature as a function of this individual investment of microbes into enzyme production. So you see that for any level of exoenzyme production, basically soil carbon stock decreases as temperature increases, but you also see that for any given temperature, as the investment in enzyme production increases, the carbon stock also decreases. So the question that we're asking is, assuming that there is genetic variation in this enzyme production fraction or investment by microbes, where does the eco-evo feedback take the system, and in particular the soil organic carbon stock? So when you look at the evolution of exoenzyme production, well, you find that it's evolutionary unstable. So if you look at this trait, this microbial trait across time will be the effect of natural selection, well, basically it goes down. And the reason is intuitive. This trait is a cooperative trait. It's a exoenzymes are a diffusible public good, and so selection is acting very strongly against it. So it takes taking the fine-grained spatial structure of the system into account to find that exoenzyme production can actually evolve towards a stable value. And we can look at that from a mathematical and computational point of view and see how strains that invest more into exoenzyme production can actually invade a system as it's shown here. So with that explanation for the evolutionary stability of exoenzyme production, we can look at how the ESS, the stable strategy favored by natural selection, actually depends and varies with temperature. I won't go into details, but we can get a formula, we can get an equation that gives us this optimal allocation to enzyme production as a function of temperature. And so this is the graph that I showed you before. And the result, the general result, is that exoenzyme production actually increases, the optimal exoenzyme production actually increases with temperature. So we're in the case where temperature increases the loss of soil organic carbon for eco-physiological reason, but we also have a negative effect of evolution via the evolution of this trait that also tends to decrease soil organic carbon. So we expect the two together to really cause a sharper decrease in soil organic carbon in response to warming. And to test this prediction, we parameterized our model for five ecoregions, from Alaska, Maine, West Virginia, California, and a warm Costa Rica, we predicted the purely ecophysiological response, loss of soil organic carbon, and then we predicted the evolutionary effect, the additional effect of evolution on that. And the results here are shown for the same ecoregions ranked by temperature. And without going into details, basically what you see is that in all cases, as predicted by the general model, evolution tends to increase strongly the loss of organic carbon in response to warming. And this effect is especially strong at low temperature in high latitudes. The next step we did with this study was to extend it to global scale. So basically, we used data on soils, including litter inputs, to predict what should be the adapted investment in exoenzyme production by microbes in the soil. We predicted the expected soil carbon stock at a given year for which we had data, which allowed us to test the quality of the model. And then we ran projections of this model over the next 100 years, and we measured the change in global soil carbon stock with and without evolution. And we ran different scenarios, just focusing on one. This is a scenario without evolution, where there is basically all together by summing over the whole terrestrial, global terrestrial ecosystem, there is very little change in soil carbon stock due to just the eco-physiological response. But when you combine evolution with that, you get quite a significant drop in the global carbon stock. So the conclusion is that adaptation to warming drives a global average decomposition rate up, and therefore the global soil organics carbon stock down. And evolutionary adaptation consistently worsens projections of soil carbon feedback to climate warming. This loss of carbon in the soil goes into the atmosphere as CO2. Now looking at basically the same question, but in the ocean, we looked at the eco-evo dynamics of the microbial loop in response to warming and its consequence for primary production. So our model is basically an NPZ model in which we have an explicit microbial loop that basically drive or contribute to nutrient cycling in the system. And the critical trait here that is potential target of evolution is microbial growth efficiency. So again, it's the trade-off. The trade-off that is involved is the one between investing into growth versus investing into degradative enzymes. And again, we can find the evolutionarily stable, optimal investment into enzyme production or growth. We can write it as a function of temperature. I won't go into the details, but the general conclusion is that the investment in growth decreases in response to warming, or as in the case of soil, investment in degradative enzymes increases with warming. And this is a very general result that we then applied to four parameters relevant to four types of ecoregion: cold and nutrient rich, cold and nutrient poor, warm and nutrient rich, and warm and nutrient poor. And for each of these regions, you can project by running simulations over the broad range of parameters what would be the effect on primary production of a purely ecophysiological response, the adaptive effect, and the combined effect of ecophysiology and evolution. And you see that basically in the case of nutrient-rich region, taking into account evolution predicts an increase, a significant increase in primary production through here and there, whereas in regions that are nutrient poor, basically evolution, the adaptive effect, counters the effect of ecophysiology, and you end up with basically a zero response of primary production. So now the third example of modeling eco-evo feedbacks and how they shape ecosystem function that I will mention briefly is one that deals with the emerging ecosystems in the earlier Archean and how they may have a feedback to the atmosphere and the climate. So just as a brief introduction here, I would like to emphasize that merge work when looking at this deep past questions of emerging ecosystem has been done to elucidate the physical chemical conditions and processes required for the non-life-life transition. And little is known about the conditions for the emergence of ecosystems, that's a question that we touched on before, and how their function and evolution changes the planetary geochemical environment. And even less work is done about how geochemical processes and ecosystem evolution feedback onto each other and how this feedback loop jointly shapes life systems and the planetary environment and their dynamics. So if we look at very primitive ecosystems, well, they were likely pre-photosynthetic, although anoxic photosynthesis may have evolved quite early, and every study that comes out on the topic seems to push the date further back. But assuming they were pre-photosynthetic, the energetics were based on redox chemistry and methanogenesis. In general, methane cycling metabolisms are reasonable candidates for the earliest metabolisms on Earth. Well, actually, scenarios of early metabolic evolution can be based on a relatively short catalog of possible electron donors and acceptors. So we can make a fairly reasonable list of possible early transitions in metabolisms and ecosystem function. So the scenario I would consider here briefly is one of an emerging methane cycling ecosystem where we start with hydrogenotrophic methanogens, assumed to be ancestral, and then heterotrophs evolve, and that may include CO-based acetogens and acetotrophic methanogens. So again, the ecosystem function consequences here is basically production of methanes here and there. And then this sets the stage for an evolutionary transition, evolutionary innovation, and establishment of methanotrophs. That's something to eat. How do we model such ecosystems? That could be an entire talk, of course. Well, these ecosystems are energy limited. We need to account for the catabolic reactions that provide the energy to drive anabolism and provide energy for maintenance. We can write thermodynamic constraints for that. And from there, we can write kinetic equations that eventually gives you a model for biomass production. Then we can couple this kind of metabolic ecosystem models with the planetary environment. And so we can use a geoclimate model that provides the condition for metabolic function and evolution. And that can include macro evolution with metabolic innovation, as well as micro evolution, like evolution of cell size for a given metabolism. And the two components of the model, the biological and the geophysical, talk to each other with these feedbacks that are included between the two. So once we have such a framework in place, we can ask questions like how likely habitable was early Earth to this kind of methanogens, how much biomass was produced, were there significant feedbacks to atmosphere and climate, and how did metabolic evolution change that? And so we did that by specifying a model for early Earth that was basically taken as an ocean world. And we ran massive Monte Carlo simulations, paying special attention to parameters like the rate of H2 outgassing and the mixing ratio of CO2. And what we found, keep a long story short, is that the cool early Earth, which is the consensus based on abiotic carbon cycle modeling, was habitable by a large fraction of the simulated methanogenic metabolism, so quite hospitable conditions for this kind of metabolisms. And we found that the impact of these metabolisms was quite large. So if you start with an Earth at 12 degrees Celsius, which is one of the outcome of the abiotic carbon cycling modeling, the effect of the methanogen metabolisms is to raise the temperature by about 10 degrees, and this is pretty much insensitive to the outgassing of dehydrogen that you assume. At the same time, you can predict biomass production, and we see that this is about 1,000 times lower in best case scenario than the current primary production under contemporary conditions. So very low biomass production and still a large effect on climate of these methanogens. An interesting feature of the model is that if you now assume that methanol trophy evolves, well, this is a consequence on temperature. Start with a cool or cold Earth, see the evolution of methanogens, the temperature rises, then you have a carbon cycle that feeds back and stabilizes temperature, and then methanol troughs evolve and basically eat up methane at a time when CO2 is also rare in the atmosphere, and the consequence of that is a radical shift in climate and temperature and potentially glaciation. And so what you can then do with this kind of model is test the effect of the pace of a rate of evolution on this phenomenon. And what we find is depending on the time when methanotrophs evolve in the system, you may or may not end up in this state of glaciation. And you have these blue dots here that show you simulations in which glaciation occur as a function of the time that you wait for the methanotrophs to evolve in the system. So if the methanotrophs evolve early, you don't end up with much of this glaciation snowball Earth risk. But if the evolution is slow, the risk of this early snowball effect is actually quite large. So some concluding remarks. With large population size and genetic variation, microbiomes are potential mediators of co-evolutionary feedbacks with global ecosystem significance. And I was delighted to hear viruses mentioned. They might play actually a major role in these feedbacks, and this is something that we actively study in my lab at this moment. As early as in the early Earth ocean world, eco-evo feedbacks driven by metabolic innovation were potentially climate destabilizing and may have been responsible for the first snowball Earth, unless evolution was fast enough to dodge it. Both on land and in the sea, eco-evolutionary models predict significant increases in microbial-driven nutrient cycling in response to warming, with soil organic carbon stock decreasing and marine NPP increasing as a consequence. And so the next steps clearly is will be to couple such ecosystem models and atmosphere climate models for our contemporary system and integrating across land and sea. So with that, I think Chris's workshop sets the perfect stage for discussion, and I'd be happy to answer questions at this point or later. Thank you.
Thank you, Régis, very much. Lots of interesting data ideas there. Do we have any questions? In terms of evidence of activity of methanogens and methanotrophs in influencing climate and perhaps provoking, yeah, as you said, snowball Earth events, I guess we don't really have data, right, from the fossil record to help us understand the influence of these organisms during the history of life on Earth, do we?
Yeah, that's right. So we are at a time where the geological record is poor. So we cannot really look for signs of that, or at least at this point. And maybe Andy would have suggestions on what might be done about it. We're also working on applying these models to early Mars, where geological record might be more amenable to examination in the light of these predictions.
Yeah, I can make a few comments. First, thanks for that, Rajar. I really liked all of it, and from my perspective, particularly the part on the early Earth. We have one slender piece of evidence for a biological methane cycle in the Archean, and it simply comes from the observation that you can have very high carbon isotope fractionation associated with methanogenesis and then methanotrophy that puts it back into the isotopically light methane back into the organic carbon pool. And that goes back, you know, certainly more than 3 billion years. The interesting thing is that, and it's just a little fill-up on the model that you gave, we do have evidence of snowball glaciation at about 2.4 billion years, and that at least corresponds in time with the rise of atmospheric oxygen. So one of the things that may be important in sort of populating the methanogenesis methylotrophy model is that when you have to couple methylotrophy to either sulfate reduction or iron reduction, which have both been demonstrated, you're going to be limited by oxidants. Once oxygen comes in, then it's at least been hypothesized that that basically scrubs methane from the atmosphere with the climatic consequences you talked about.
So, absolutely. So it would be the same kind of effect that we would have had like a billion year earlier or more with the first appearance of methanotrophs. But yes, that's exactly the same mechanism, in fact. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, okay. I think we need a coffee or a tea now, so that's great. Thank you, Regis, for closing that. We're over schedule, but it doesn't matter. We anyhow have time for further questions later, so we'll come back to some of the topics you brought up, I'm sure, particularly in terms of land, sea, interfaces, yeah. So let's go for a coffee and let's do 15 minutes, okay? So we'll come back quarter past the hour. And as I say, I think we have time to keep going later. So, all right, so see you in 15 minutes. Thanks again.